The colored picture here is a photograph of Nicolas Poussin, of one of his last great paintings. It's entitled Apollo and Daphne. And on the black and white detail is the center detail of the painting. And we're going to mention Poussin in the lecture. And we're also going to talk about Raphael. So let me just put up Raphael's great painting, The School of Athens. I don't know how well this comes across on camera. We'll do better visuals at another time, factor them in electronically. Raphael's School of Athens is in the Vatican and is the greatest painting of the Renaissance. Nicolas Poussin is the founder of classicism in painting, the kind of classicism that was objected to by the Impressionists, the Surrealists, the Romanticists, the Cubists, the Futurists, the Etceterists. If you've never had an Etceterist headache, there are no pills for that one. You are the pill. We come to these paintings prematurely because we don't get to art for another 3 months or so. But they're elicited by Yeats, and we're looking at Yeats. We're looking at his book, A Vision, and we're pairing his book, A Vision, with Plato's Timaeus, Plato's dialogues, and Yeats' poetry form a kind of a bookend. They're parentheses within which the last 2,400 years of Western civilization have matured and developed and left us high and dry. And so we are trying to understand this enormous context out of which we have been thrown. We've been thrust ashore. We can no longer swim in that civilization. We don't have traction anymore in that particular civilization. But all the problems that we have, all the resistances, all the promises that we have, all the prophecies, everything comes from that matrix. And so we need to understand what those guys were doing, what that kind of human beings were about, because they have left us with conditions and situations and structures which are our only effective tools. And so we have to understand what they have done, or to put it more paranoically, what they have done to us. In a very frank way, we've been booby-trapped. We only function in a reductive way. And so we have to learn to say no and mean it. But to what are we saying no? And to what could we say yes? All of this is very difficult. And so our education is a process of discovery. And what we're trying to discover here is what not to do at the same time as to get some insights in what possibilities there are that we might do. And slowly we're trying to let the possibilities overtake the negative rejections, which must be a part of our heritage now. We're busy, at least for the next generation, for the next 20 years of our lives, being increasingly specific about what we don't want, what we don't want to keep, what we want to throw out. And yes, purists can archive it, but don't let it jam up our psyches. Don't let it gum up our activities. And yet at the same time, our psyches and our activities do not have an open or clear access to the feasibility of a future which we could either imagine for ourselves or remember to modify for ourselves. And so we're like orphans of the storm, to use a D.W. Griffith phrase. We're cast up onto a shore, the continent of which we don't recognize, we don't know. We've come out of a situation that's no longer tenable for us, and yet we have to familiarize ourselves with it, long enough at least to be intelligent about dealing with its legacies. And the legacies are formidable. All of the structures of civilization, the political structures, the religious structures, the sociological functions, the psychological predilections, the legal, the medical, everything has been stylized, engraved, and delivered to us before we were born in such a way that the inculcation of these conditions has stifled at least three generations before us. You have to go back to a great grandmother generation to find human beings who were at home in the civilization that we're talking about. Because our grandparents already were having trouble with it. And our parents didn't do very well with it. And we're not doing very well with it. But we can't afford to make the mistake that the parent generation made. And that is to reject something completely without knowing what it is that you're trying to get rid of. Because when you reject completely, it's literally like assigning your intelligence to tear out all of the hard wiring by which you exist. And so it turns out that freedom, the need for freedom, the need for openness, becomes a self-destructive activity. And so it's fraught with paradox, all the time, every time. Now, the only way to get free from this, and without the caveat, there is another way to get free with it, free from it, and that's the Uncle Remus caveat, the tar baby. You can wait until somebody who wants to eat you up pulls you loose from the tar baby, and then hope that by your cleverness you can get them to throw you into the briar patch. Do you know about Uncle Remus? Do you know about Br'er Rabbit and the tar baby to American? Br'er Fox and Br'er Rabbit are always antagonists. The one wants to eat the other wants to tease the former. So Br'er Fox gets this idea of making a tar baby, making this little golem that sits on a log with a hat and a corncob pipe and an old coat, because he knows that Br'er Rabbit comes along this path every morning. And I'm sure some of you maybe have seen the Disney version where he sings zippity-doo-dah, zippity-yay. And he says good morning to everything. And when he says good morning to the tar baby, it doesn't say anything. And of course, he takes this as an affront. And so Br'er Rabbit goes back. He's sort of like a deeper archetypal Bugs Bunny. And he says, if you don't say good morning to me with a smile, I'm going to whoop you, which is Uncle Remus talk for slugging. And then, of course, the tar baby says nothing, and behind this bush, Br'er Bear and Br'er Fox are chuckling. And Br'er Rabbit whoops him with his one paw, and it gets stuck. And he says right away, if you don't let go, I'm going to whoop you with the other, which he does, and it gets stuck. And pretty soon, both feet and both hands, and pretty soon, his head And all 5 points of the energy cycle are stuck in the tar baby. The four corners of his frame of reference plus his center are all stuck in the tar baby. And of course, his Uncle Remus tells the story. Brer Fox and Brer Bear saunter out from behind the bush. And Brer Fox says in his most syrupy southern style, "My, my. Yawn viciousness has you stuck here. Brer Bear, it looks like we're going to have dinner." And it's only by his wits that Brer Rabbit says to them as they pull him loose from the tar baby, this is the caveat, you can get out of the situation if something really powerful enough that wants to get you releases you from that. Brer Rabbit says, "Well, now, I don't mind being eaten. You can fricassee really good. I'd be all right that way. You could even broil me. You could roast me. All that's just fine by me. But please, don't throw me into that thorny briar patch there. You can do whatever you want with me, but don't throw me into that briar patch." And eventually, after many suggestions, hypnotic and otherwise, NLP and otherwise, Brer Fox says, "Shut up, I am going to throw you into that briar patch," which he does. And in the Disney version, they do it very well, where you see this thorny growth and this, "Oh, ah, oh, ah, oh, ah," and the camera goes to the smiling Brer Rabbit, who's sniffing little flowers there. And he says, an aside to the audience, he says, "I was born in this briar patch. I'm very much at home here." You can get out of Western civilization by the caveat of the tar baby if you're clever enough to get yourself out of the hands of something powerful enough to take you out. What would be powerful enough to take you out? A transpersonal ideology, communism, fascism, all isms are powerful enough to take you out. But then you're in the hands of the ism, and the isms only want to eat you. They don't have any use for your person. They only have use for your existence, your body count for the cause. Eric Hoffer, a longshoreman philosopher in San Francisco, wrote a beautiful little book about 40 years ago called The True Believer. And the theme is that people who have causes, the ismites, are always ready to have you die for their cause, to have you sacrificed for their cause. Their only interest in you is as a body count. Your person is what they don't want. Now, other than the tar baby caveat, the only opportunity to get out of the situation, to get out of a conditional, is the classic way of dissolving the conditions. But in order to dissolve them, you have to know solvents. And the study of solvents is what old wisdom education was always about. The alchemical cooks have been around for many phases of civilization, many versions of it, and they remember, they know the recipes to make the solvents that can dissolve this gum away from you, get you unstuck, get you unglued. But their problem for us is that they're not isms at all. They're never isms. And so it doesn't seem like it's going to work. It doesn't seem like it's powerful enough to do the job. And so we tend to, in our clever way, opt for an ism, thinking that we're going to be clever enough to not be got by the ism. And the isms are going to free us from this situation. It's a gamble. The house odds are against you. Good luck. But the education is much more difficult initially. But if you take that route, its effectiveness is above 90%. You can almost be guaranteed, almost promised that you'll have better than a fighting chance. You'll have a running chance to succeed. But the difficulty is just the opposite as with the isms. With the isms, the difficulty comes as the punchline. With a transformational education, the difficulty is at the beginning. It's like one of the phrases from the I Ching, difficulty at the beginning. Because it doesn't seem like anything's happening. And the reason it doesn't seem like anything is happening is because you're working on developing a solvent. You're not adding to what's happening. You're developing a solvent to dissolve what's happening. You can always later re-inculcate ritual comportments. You can learn them in a matter of hours. You can relearn them certainly in a matter of days or weeks. Whatever you really need to live, you can teach yourself again. So you don't have to fear that the solvents are going to erase something irreparable. The difficulty is that the developing of wisdom education solvents takes a while for it to work, and it doesn't work the way in which the ingrained habitual forms seem to have efficacy, because the solvents are meant to dissolve them, and they don't have that kind of existential apparentness. So with this education, it takes a while. And the only way that you can tell that something's happening is that after a while, you lose that anxiety that nothing's happening. The first indication that the education is beginning to have effect is that you lose the anxiety. Not the anxiety of the resistances, that increases. Because you notice that more situations, more things are aggravating, are not right. But you lose that more profound existential anxiety, that impatience to get out, because you can always feel the quality that something is stirring. The old Neoplatonic way of saying it, you're beginning to have your soul grow its wings back. And you can always fly above that mess. So the wisdom education way of transcending the situation is almost always effective if you stay in there. But you have to stay in there without having any assurance, any veracity. The second way that you know that something's happening is that when you do a comparison, when you do a before and after comparison, you begin to notice that there is a differential, that what was characteristic of you before now is markedly different. For instance, if some of you have been in the series for a while, if you compare something, say, 6 months ago with today, you would find that there would be a marked difference. The easiest way to do this would be to take two tapes. Take a tape of today's lecture. Take a tape of a lecture, say, 6 months, 7 months ago, 8 months, whatever you like. You were there at that lecture 6 or 7 months ago. You have a memory, more or less, of it. Play the tape for yourself. How much of it is new? How much did you not hear? And you can do this while the education is going on. You can take a tape, say from the first time that you were here, and you can play it for yourself every 3 months, and you will hear more that's new than what you remembered that you did know. So that the process of opening up, of disclosing by exploration and discovery, begins to outstrip the habitual conditional inculcation more and more. In fact, it's a geometric progression. So that while you'll hear a little bit more after 3 months, you'll hear a lot more after 6 months, and after a year, there just won't be any comparison. What's great about this kind of an education is that it continues to work for you for the rest of your life. 10 years from now, you'll hear ever so much more. But this openness has to be recognized as open. It's not a thing. It's not a perimeter. It's not a definition. It's not a frame of reference. It's nothing you can grasp. Its efficacy lies in the exact fact that it is not graspable. But it is appreciable. But appreciation has a quality to it which takes experience and allows for experience to internalize. Now, in terms of our education, the experience level is the level of language. I don't know if you saw in the Los Angeles Times yesterday that psychological experiments have now ascertained that little tiny babies can pick out real words out of nonsense phrases even when they're just a few months old. They've never looked at dictionaries in their life. How do they know that? Because there's a built-in comprehension about form, formed experience, and language delivers formed experience in such a way that it characterizes our species. And the development of this is not the development of a baby over a few weeks of life in this particular life cycle, but the experience prelude is over billions of years of life developing its capacities, its sensitivities towards this. It's like the physiological atomic elements in our bodies. We're all made in the interior of stars. And only when stars went through a supernova or nova phase, and those elements heavier than hydrogen or helium, or the occasional lithium atom, the only atomic structures that were ever universal, all the other elements, the iron, the calcium, the oxygen, all of these were made in the interiors of stars. And so our physiology literally is celestial. Our body not only is celestial, but it remembers the universe on that level. We're a seamless part of it. But just as the existence, the existential parts of ourselves are structurally rooted in the very process of natural reality, and it shows up in the very definite structure of our ritual body, our objective, active ritual body, so too, as long as life has been a process and life is endemic in the universe, anywhere that the molecular structures that are necessary to the amino acids, to the various other chemical developments, the hydroxyl molecules, all of these exist, not only on many planets and on many moons of very large planets, but they exist in interstellar space between the stars. They even are detectable by modern astrophysical techniques in intergalactic space. Gas clouds in intergalactic space have organic molecules already in them. So life is endemic to the universe. And wherever one has a process of life, the language capacity of life is already forming, already at work. So our dossier that we could present at those pearly gates, at that expectation of demanding that we have our own personal individuality, our dossier that proves that we're capable of this goes back billions of years. So that the baby that learns to pick out words at just a couple of months of age is not a prodigy. It's what is rather normal for life. Now, on the level of language we have seen, that is traditionally called the mythological level, the level of myth. Because language tends not just to identify words, that's rather a mental configuration that is indexed and retrospectively introduced into language. The processes of language on experience level, on feeling level, the mythological level, is that they tend to sequence. And those sequences tend to have a play of images. And the play of images is just that. It plays at going off, of taking directions, of making curves, or making arcs, or making curlicues, or having interesting lines of development. Language tends to have this capacity. Now, originally, it's rather truncated, and that capacity only gets expressed in interjections or guttural sounds, truncated words. But as soon as there is a capacity for an extended development, it happens. Not limited to our particular species, not even limited to our particular form of experiential comprehension. For instance, everyone knows that birds sing, bird songs. The California mockingbird has the largest repertoire of songs in the world, even outstripping the Iranian nightingale. It never has learned to read music. It doesn't have any tape recorder to learn to sing. They all sing. Even little tiny birds sing. This capacity for birds to sing, or for whales to sing, this capacity for ourselves to sing in sets of sound that are so precise that one could have a mathematical designation for the tonality and the pitch, like Schoenberg's 12-tone song, is amazing. But all of this originally is characteristic of the way in which organic life on an experiential level has an intelligibility about feeling that sequences itself. And that sequencing, when it gets extended, not very far, just a little ways, as soon as the sequencing of language is a capability, there's an interiorization of the meaning. And for us, because our language capacities are so remarkable, because they're set up to be exponential, in a natural physiological way, if a human baby is born and raised in wolf-like, Tarzan-type conditions, it will not develop language very far, guttural sounds. If that child were not given a human context in which to develop its language skills by the age of 9, that child will never be able to speak a language, never be able to read, will physiologically be unable to utilize the whole realm of language. Because the formation of the brain takes place at such a rapid rate, it gels, and as it gels, its physiological function is opened up to the extent of the way in which the interiorized play has occurred and has happened. A child raised trilingually, bilingually, quadrilingually, multilingually, will have that facility for the rest of their lives. If a child is given at least one language, it will have the facility to work a variant structure off that and learn other languages. But the longer that one goes in doing this, the less likelihood of it being usable. We're at the point now, we're at symbols, and the interiorization process of language, the interiorization of feeling, the interiorization of myth constellates certain relationalities and doesn't do it politely, but does it dynamically. It's an implosion. It's like a bomb going off backwards. And the interiorization of feeling implodes so forcefully sometimes with such comprehension from so many different angles that the forms that happen are not just images, but they are symbols. Really high-powered, exponentially powered symbol has the ability to index any number of images. Whereas an image initially is thought of as being some kind of a picture of something outside, actually it's an impress of what is out there. But the impress is not just an imitation of it, but is always a creative gestalt. So that images have this creative gestalt-like quality and character. And when they're alerted to, energized by symbols, they have an indefinite extension of their referentiality. A symbol confers onto an image base a larger referentiality than simple one for one. If you spell it out, the very first level, the very first indication that images have exceeded their one for one referentiality is that one begins to feel, to develop a sense of irony. That it's ironical that such and such an image should refer just to such and such an object. The sense of irony is the first beginning. And that irony deepens into a sense of paradox. There's an intermediate phase where it seems weird, where it seems strange, where it seems unusual. It's a kind of a quality of like a deja vu, only in a puzzling way, where irony becomes a sense of oddness, which is the beginnings, as Charles Baudelaire wrote, the development of humor seems to have a tie with the way in which one will have a sense of irony that deepens into a paradox in the same way that the sense of humor deepens into an appreciation of absurdity. The surrealist, as well as the impressionist, used Baudelaire's theory of comedy and theory of art to develop their own intuitions. And next year we'll take a look at it even deeper. And it isn't just because of Baudelaire being French. It's a universal quality. When it comes to expressing imagery that's been energized by symbols, one has stepped over into a new capacity. You not only can say something which has a natural referent to it, but now you can say something which, in addition to the natural referent, has an allegorical hidden meaning, a deeper meaning. And the sense of allegory can deepen even further. In fact, it can go several orders deeper than that. And eventually, one can come up with a series of four different levels of referentiality at the same time when one has a very deep and active symbol quality. For instance, in Dante, in the Divine Comedy, every image in Dante can be read on four different levels at the same time. There's four different capacities. Because Dante is really a tremendous development. Dante's Divine Comedy does to Virgil's Aeneid what Homer's Odyssey did to Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad is about the stepping out of the bounds of the given context, the stepping out of the bounds of the civilization, of the situation, only doing it in this violent way. The ism that is used to bring largely men, but also women in the Iliad, to bring them out of the tar baby stuck way, is the ism of militarism, of war. The Iliad is about organized violence on the level of war, which will bring people out of their tar baby like stuck, secure existence and thrust them into something exciting, something different. Part of the difficulty of bringing war to an end, it's the only way in which half-asleep men ever experience transcendence. But Homer's Iliad is about going out, and then the problem is how do you come home? And the Odyssey was about how you come home. It's very difficult to come home. Almost nobody ever comes home. Almost nobody who goes out in that way ever makes it back to any kind of humane life. I remember being absolutely driven to despair in Berkeley in the mid-1960s. We were counseling returning Vietnam veterans as early as 1966. And these kids who were 18 who were taken over and trained to become killers and then were sent back at age 19 to go back to school. And they came back, instead of being farm boys from Wisconsin, had become natural born killers. They'd killed children, they'd killed women for their country, for whatever it was, under orders, whatever it was. It was indigestible. And what became asymptotically indigestible was that there was no way to come back. Because everything that had been home to them was now absurd. It was allegorically supercharged into a nightmare. And just the most ordinary apple pie dessert for dinner became an image that was horrific, absolutely horrific. And of course, the briar patch way out was some kind of mind-altering drug. Let's do something to get out of this. And so a lot of the motive for drugs in the 60s was to overcome this kind of impossible condition. Let's take a chance on the briar patch. Very few make it through. There were very few people who at that time went into the transcendental wisdom education way, and most of those perished on the way. It's almost like Ishmael in Moby Dick saying, "I alone have survived to tell you the story." Still here. Survived it. Survived all of it. The difficulty is because there doesn't seem to be anything happening. And the only thing that a good friend can say to you is that that's a good sign. The sign that nothing is happening is the best indication that something very much larger than the context of ordinary identification is underway. And it takes a long time. And you never actually get to the sense that you can identify that something is happening. But in this comparative quality of the sense of irony, of the sense of allegory, the sense of paradox, these feeling-toned intelligences begin to work in you. They're juices that are freed in you. And as those juices mature, they have the capacity to dissolve the structures that make the impossibilities, to dissolve the forms that make resistances even feasible. They take the CO out of combat so that there just isn't any juice to it anymore. And so while the episodes of resistance, of fighting, of combat, of anxiety still occur, they don't have the old oomph. And after a while, it becomes a problem of equanimity and of compassion, because once you're freed from those kinds of demonic, savage, compulsory inculcations, one of the gut-level responses is to lash out at them with impunity. They have chained me for decades of my life. How in the hell do they dare do that? And of course, that's the way in which they snag you back in. And they reel you all the way back into the boat. And one has to, in a wisdom education, learn to temper that one's not only dealing with the positive combat, but at the same time balancing with that of dealing with the negative combat that's just as insidious. So the Bhagavad Gita says, evenness of mind is yoga. But it also says the mind is the slayer of the real. Because the mind, as distinct from the brain, tends to transcend the integrated forms. The brain always eventually accepts, by physiologically making a place for integration to have objectivity. The brain objectifies nature to the nth degree, but the mind always transcends the brain. And it uses an exponential of language to do that. But in order for that magic language to come in, that transcendental language to come in, the mythological language has to come down, has to be chilled to absolute zero. You have to chill the mythologies to absolute zero. Otherwise, the transcendence is not clean, it's not clear. And when you're carrying a lot of stuff over from mythology into vision, into consciousness, without being aware that you're doing this, it's like that snag. It pulls you back regressively, and instead of consciousness being a liberating dimension. It becomes an extra level of cleverness to the resistances. They gain your effort. The demons are now armed with pitchforks. So it's a quality that one needs to tend to. Benjamin Franklin, in his wonderful hermetic wisdom, summed it up, and we'll use this as a summation and then take a break. Benjamin Franklin said, "God sends meat, but the devil sends cooks, and they can ruin anything." Let's take a break. We're talking about situations that we're all in. We were born into them, and we've had to live in them, and we would like to find some way to at least modify, if not get out of them. But the layers of the problem are so comprehensive that we're sewn in, literally sewn in, and we can either be taken out in kind of a violent way and take our chances on being clever, or we have the other option, which is to have the patience and the tenacity to strategically learn to not do what the episodes cue us to do. And it's very difficult. I'd like to give you a contrast. I'm going to use two poems by W.B. Yeats. One, when he was a naturally gifted young man, writing a poem about what seemed to him to be the ultimate worthwhile. And then a poem later in his career where he realized that all the natural qualities that he desired when he was younger were highly suspect, in fact, nightmarish. And only at that point did he realize that he had to do something radical to get out of an entrapment which was insidiously complete. The first poem, just give you these two poems, they're both very famous by Yeats. The first is the Lake Isle of Innisfree. Innisfree is a little island, one of several dozen islands that's in a lake or a low gill, that's in the west of Ireland around where Yeats grew up. So here's the brilliant world-class poet is a young man. This is his paradise. "I will arise and go now and go to Innisfree and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honeybee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the vales of the morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, an evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore, while I stand on the roadway or on the pavement's gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core." Second poem is called The Second Coming. When that entire natural paradise has become permanently, nightmarishly suspect. Same man, a little further on in the development of symbolic consciousness. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed and everywhere. The ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of the Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, and now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. So that the phrase, the second coming, which for 2,000 years was such a promise of resurrection, now is the threat of extinction. A blank gaze of the ultimate psychic stormtroopers who simply march over us and through us for purposes that have nothing to do with our lives, our loves, or ourselves. This was written on the eve of World War II in a vision that Yeats had. The difference between desiring to go to the Lake Isle of Innisfree when the young Yeats was influenced still by Thoreau, having read Walden, he wanted to go and have his little encampment, like Thoreau wanting to go to Walden Pond and build a little cabin. Emerson owned the land and said, of course, you can build a cabin there. And Walden was Thoreau's way of going back into nature. But if one reads Thoreau deeper, his going back into nature was influenced by the American Indian vision quests. So just as Yeats was influenced by Thoreau, Thoreau was influenced by the ancient Indians who used to live in that area of Massachusetts, used to live around Concord. And he wanted to go and tune himself back into nature in such a way that the old Paleolithic wisdom would occur to him again. Thoreau wrote in one of his journals in this winter of 1840, he said, I have stood with the trees in a snowstorm to participate with them in surveying the winter at existence's first hand. So, like the American Indian wisdom, the old North American Indians still had the Paleolithic hunter wisdom, even up until historical times, that the way in which one lives in a larger reality is first of all to participate in nature, because nature is a mystery. And by participating, by folding into nature, one folds into the mystery. And the mystery of the process of nature is that it emerges. And so Paleolithic men and women who participated in the mystery emergence of nature were given the gift of developing life, because this is the way in which nature works. Nature not only is a mystery process, but it records existence. Bodies happen. They're really there. And they really do what bodies do. They exist. They're a focus for the mysterious processes of nature to come together in a life-giving way. And so Paleolithic men and women, in their mystery wisdom, would dance to get back into the rhythmic harmony of the processes of nature. And when their existence was aligned to nature's mysterious processes, then almost without effort, the level of feeling that comes out of the body, the language that comes off the tongue, begins to have a process which is in syncopation with nature, that the processes of nature and the processes of experiential mythology are paralleled. And so by ritual alignment, wise Paleolithic men and women kept track and made sure that the wild processes of the mystery of nature were in sync with the creative processes of language, of experience, of mythology. And they ensured that this was a reality, that this happened, and they were healthy, and they survived well, and they got all of us here. But with Neolithic civilization, instead of participating in the mystery of nature, Neolithic men and women tamed the animals, tamed the plants, but at the same time then had to tame themselves. And in taming, they had to select. And so Paleolithic wisdom went out of fashion and Neolithic wisdom came in. And the Neolithic wisdom, instead of having the virtues of the male hunter, had the virtues of the female farmer, had those virtues of the patient centering, that one holds the patient center while the cycle gains its equilibrium by pivoting. And so that the whole feminine wisdom of maintaining a pivot so that the cyclic motion, the seasonal motion, would have equanimity. And that one could check this equanimity. Are the solstices in sync? Are they in a kind of a parallel? Do the equinoxes hold a parallel? And if the four seasons hold a parallel like that, then the whole ritual year is in sync with the natural year. And the whole mythological cycle, the mythological year, the ritual year, and the natural year are wheels within wheels, way up in the air. It's the way Ezekiel said it when Ezekiel was in exile in Babylonia, looking at the Chubar River, which is the old Tigris River. And looking at the flow of the river, Ezekiel had vision from God. He saw that the flow of nature happens even in exile, and that the exile is some kind of superimposed vignette of man's making, and nature hasn't changed. Nature is still natural, it's still mysterious. And if one participates in the mystery of nature, then the rituals, the body, what we do can still align. and the language will still parallel. And men and women will be free. But in Ezekiel's time, the difficulty was that symbols had come into play in such a tenacious way that they had to be included in the cycle. That the mind's forms had to be included. And so when Ezekiel would look up from the Chubar rivers flowing, and he looked at the pure sky, what he saw, not flying saucers, that's puerile compared to what he saw. He saw wheels within wheels within wheels way up in the air. He saw that the whole target nature of the concentric circles of cycles was only balanceable by keeping a pivot, which was, as Ezra Pound used the phrase one time, unwobbling. Not that it's stable, because it can have a dynamic quality to it, but unwobbling, so that the cycles, instead of flip-flopping, have this kind of humming harmony. And when it has that hum, that harmony, it has a quality. One can hear it, one can feel it. It's like a great race driver who gets into his vehicle, and by the 300th lap in Indiana at 200 miles an hour has every nuance of the track down, and the cycle becomes deeper than hypnotic. It becomes releasing. And instead of there being flash, split-second decisions in driving, the flow becomes one of a mystical participation. You'll never miss the curve because you're a part of the curve. You could be going 500 miles an hour. You make it easy. And as long as you stay within that, all great athletes experience that, where they have a run on their capacity and their body has folded into the ritual comportment, which is aligned with the mystery of nature, and also aligned with the feeling expressiveness of whatever language one is dealing with, and that can align with the symbol, which is that pivot, that axis, that unwobbling pivot. And then the entire cycle of integration happens without any effort whatsoever. And it takes only the imaginative inclination, the intuitive, it's like the comic strip where in the thought bubble the light bulb comes on. It only takes just that much for transcendence to happen, for conscious vision to occur, for the Sahasrara chakra to simply open, and because it is open, the neurological energy can transcend the spinal column and the brain, and hover, just like the old symbol of Horus bearing the sign of eternity, hovering just over the head of the Equanimius, or the halo surrounding the saints, because they're Equanimius. And so that quintessential, that fifth dimension, that fifth quality, that fifth cycle of conscious vision is there because it's like a gift of nature. It's a gift of experience. And the visionary process, which we get to in just 2 weeks, we start talking about vision. But without the symbol to hold the unwobbling pivot, the transcendence is uncertain, is wobbly. And what happens is that because vision, because consciousness is so powerful, consciousness much more powerful than language, much more powerful than nature. Look how powerful nature is. And nature can be changed by language. Look how powerful language is. It can be changed by consciousness. And if consciousness has just the slightest little wobble in it, it sets up odd resonances that index and go back, and it changes the way in which experience records. It changes the way in which nature then reciprocates to us. And all kinds of weird things come out of this, from the slightest imbalances. So that transcendence, so that vision, so that consciousness, because of its indexing power, takes a lot of care to do it right. And what is right, not some ism, regardless of what it is, etc. ism, it is a gift, it's a deliverance that happens where the last stage of integration is acceptance. That's how one ensures that one's not forcing anything. One's not subtly loading the dice. One's not making wild cards. When integration is complete like that, the whole deck are all wild cards. They can be whatever you want. I remember my old gypsy spirit mother trying to get across to a young psychic genius who was getting into tarot card reading for big bucks, famous people, trying to show him that he was just being clever and not at all conscious about the power of symbols with his super tarot deck with gilded gold edges and nice velvet pouch and his nice velvet jacket with his velvet cape. And she took an ordinary deck of playing cards and just laid them back down. She didn't even look at the cards. And just began accounting relationality and began telling his fortune just out of that. Out of supposedly thin air. He had no idea where it came from. And she filleted him and said, in that beautiful velvet coat on the other side, you have one of my prized objects, which you have stolen from me. And if you're half the gentleman I think you are, you'll put it back before you run out. Which he did. And ran fleeing. Because she pegged him. Because when symbolic visionary consciousness is whole, you don't have to look at the spots. A really artistic gambler doesn't have to keep track of where the cards are. He knows where the cards are. He can deal you the cards. He's the dealer. He's in charge of the universe. It's going to respond to him. And a yogi who's dealing can take care of the situation, whatever it is, however complicated it is. But one has to raise vision to a high art in order to do that. But next year, when we talk about vision for 3 months, we have to follow that with talking about art for 3 months, because that's where the objectivization of consciousness comes into play in art. And the human person is an art form. The human person is not there in ritual, no matter how refined. And it's not there in the mind. It's not there in symbol, no matter how brilliant. The human person is an art form that has objectivity in the wild open reaches of consciousness. So that the spiritual person is so transcendent of the natural cycle of integration that there's no comparison whatsoever. But in order to do that, in order to be there, one has to see that you have stepped up the ladder to the top step and then jumped. You jumped off. And that jump doesn't just land you then and gravity pull back, but that jump takes a very peculiar quality. Saw a lecture at Caltech one time, Kip Thorne, whose book on black holes we use later on in the science section, Because after vision and art, there's a fourth process called history, and a fourth level of objectivity we call science, the cosmos. Kip Thorne was lecturing at Caltech one time, and he said that he stood up on a chair and he held this grapefruit. He said, if we put enough dynamic behind this grapefruit, it no longer falls back to Earth, but goes into orbit around the Earth, but that the orbit is actually a straight line. It only seems to curve around the Earth because the Earth's surface only seems to curve, but equanimity, gravitylessness, is actually a perfect straight line. He illustrated it by jumping off the chair and holding for a split second the grapefruit in straight line. It's only because he was susceptible to gravity that the motion of the grapefruit seemed to curve. Something in orbit goes in perfect straight line, but it's only because of the gravitational curve of space-time in the body of the planet that it seems like something in orbit is going around like this. In his theory of poetry, Wallace Stevens gave praise to Paul Klee. He said, Klee was great enough artist that he lived in wide enough universe that straight lines seemed to fall. When somebody is capable and conscious on that kind of scale, one learns to see. You can't see it with natural eyes. You can't see it with mythological eyes. You can't even see it with magical eyes. But with artistic eyes, then you can see. And when you see, it's like big silent wow. On that, oh, that vowel and that wow centers itself on that unwobbling pivot. And one gets this kind of paired W's of Cassiopeia scintillating. It's that kind of quality of conscious exuberance that gives us the promise of freedom, cosmic freedom. For someone like Yeats, and we're using Yeats and we're using Plato, is nominal paired text now to just give us a little bit of traction. For someone like Yeats, when he got to the level of writing The Second Coming, he couldn't go back to Innisfree and be happy at all until he had accepted the challenge of that Second Coming level of nightmare and deal with it. And as soon as he got to the level of having that scale of problem, he also, by universal law, got the capacity to solve that problem. We're never in reality given problems we can't solve. And just because it takes every ounce of our resolving power just means that we're mature to that extent. If we're given problems that challenge us 100%, it means that we're ready to develop 100%. So the scale of the problems that we have are the index to the real capacity that we have. We're never given problems we can't solve. It's universal law, universal quality. When Yeats began to try to challenge himself, he knew that you have to evoke out on level of vision, and his book of vision is what we're using, not his poems, but a vision. He used not his poetic consciousness to generate the words, the language, which then his symbolic mind was going to order. He used someone else's automatic writing, his wife. And his wife's automatic writing came from the depths of her psyche. But her psyche had been blended, had been melded, had been tuned to his. She and Yeats were so psychically affine because they had exchanged qualities, that her deep psyche, on the deep enough level where it was like universal, also touched his deep universal level. And her psyche at those archetypal depths began delivering images that not only came out of her depths, but out of his. She spoke his images as well as her own from that deep level, because on a really deep level, we all share. We're all rhizomes on a really cosmic ground. And when any of us get deep enough to touch that cosmic ground, that's why it appeals to all of us, because it's all of our same ground. He writes it this way in A Vision, page 9. On the afternoon of October 24th, 1917, 4 years after my marriage, my wife surprised me by attempting automatic writing. What came in disjointed sentences, in almost illegible writing, was so exciting, sometimes so profound, that I persuaded her to give an hour or two, day after day, to this unknown writer, this depth within herself. And eventually, she churned up a whole suitcase full of automatic writing. And Yeats, who was one of the really great magicians of the 20th century, really fine, knew that the deeper one goes, the more universal the pattern. It's like we said this morning when we began, babies a few months old can hear a real word in the midst of nonsense, because the pattern is there for billions of years. It's matured for longer than most star systems extant have been around. That capacity is that deep. Those roots are there that deep. And so Yeats saw that the illegible automatic writing script, the more and more that she accumulated this, he recognized somehow that if he could, in himself, tune himself deeper and deeper within himself, he would get to the level within himself at such a depth that it would flow with her deep level, and that he would be able to use his poetic, symbolic, insightful mind to bring the order, to bring the pattern out of her illegible imagery. She didn't have the profound symbolic mind, the poetic, the poesis as the Greek is, the ability to spontaneously form patterns. A really great poet like Yeats, very rare. There's only a few of them. In the 20th century, Yeats and Eliot and Rilke, Pablo Neruda, there's just a few. At any one time, there's only just a few. Yeats was one of them. And when he got deeper and deeper into himself, he recognized that what she was writing, the superficial today would call it channeling, that she was channeling some figure in herself. But at that deep level, it isn't figuration that's coming through. It's chaotic language before it's configured. There's no one there to configure it, because it's on a deep enough level that it comes out of the fundamental, original experience that first surfaces from existence. The depth of experience is only paper thin at that beginning. It isn't gone deep enough to make even a mythological figuration, much less somebody. There can't be somebody who channels something till one has an artistic form and consciousness. It's just a matter of understanding the psychophysics of reality. But when the body, when existence, when an existential manifestation, a rock it can be, that has the least little bit of organic quality to it, like the Mars rocks, would work. That first little nanoparticle of organic organization has the beginnings of a capacity to record experience. Has the first atom in the taproot of mythology right there. If one gets down to that depth of a level, one can understand organic rocks. You can talk with them. You can talk with plants for sure. And you can talk with psychic levels within a human being, hands down. But one needs to have this kind of a capacity that Yeats had. So he writes this way. When the automatic writing began, we were in a hotel on the edge of Ashdown Forest, but soon returned to Ireland and spent much of 1918 at Glendalough, at Ross's Point, at Coolay Park, at a house near to it, at his tower, Thor Ballet. Always more or less solitary, my wife, bored and fatigued by her almost daily task, and I thinking and talking of little else. So that one of the qualities is that at this deeper level, what works for you is what normally in conditions would work against you. Fatigue, exhaustion, hypertension, anxiety, all the little specialty sauces that the demons serve. Right, they can't take anything unseasoned. They're sauciers, right? They're gonna mix these sauces, and the more that you stew, the better they like it. They make you real tasty, right? Wait till we get through with her. The peculiarity is that in the triumph of reality, Mother Nature reciprocally makes it not only the worst condition, but the best possibility of curing it, because the cure always follows the illness. It's old medical practice. When you've been doctor for millions of years, you understand that the cure is to take the smallest particle of the disease and transform it. And when it does, it recalibrates the entire disease. You can't recalibrate the whole disease. You have to be super yogi to do that. You can do that. If you're a super yogi, you can do that. But anyone can transform one molecule of the disease, one atom of the disease. We all have enough psychic power for that. And when you reintroduce that transformed seed, it in turn recalibrates the entire disease. There's no problem with that whatsoever. The only quality is understanding that this is what happens. It's like fairy tales. If you don't believe in them, then you'll never hear them, much less tell them to others. So here's how Yeats then writes the next stage. Whenever I received a certain signal, I will explain what it was later, I would get pencil and paper ready. After they had entranced my wife, suddenly, when sitting in a chair, I suggested that she must always be lying down before they put her to sleep. They seemed ignorant of our surroundings and might have done so at some inconvenient time or place. Once, when they had given their signal in a restaurant, they explained that because we had spoken of a garden, they had thought we were in it. Except at the start of a new topic, when they would speak or write a dozen sentences unquestioned, I always had to question, and every question to rise out of a previous answer. That's the chain link, that's the linking of it. This is why when we looked at haiku in ritual, the symbolic distillation of the symbol of the haiku was taken out of a ritual comportment which was called renga in Japanese, linked verse. The one element common to all linked verse was the haiku. So the haiku abstracted symbolically out is a symbolic form, but the development of linked verse out of which haiku came is a ritual comportment. It's as simple as this. You write a verse, and the next person writes a linked verse to it on associative basis. And the next person on associative basis writes a linked verse to that. And so one goes round robin, and one has the linked verse, one has the Renga. And this poem is a group poem, not of an artistic personality, not even of a symbolic mind, but of a ritual community. And on that basis, language gets to be very close to the mystery of nature, very close to it. And you can refine it so that it's only one layer away. So Yeats would do this. He did this with his wife. As soon as he got into this deep enough, he began to recognize, spontaneously recognize, that there was a frame of reference. We've called it in this education a square of attention. It's a universal form. The frame of reference, the square of attention, always has a pair of parallels that connect together to make that kind of reference, to make it viable. Otherwise, it isn't viable. And that square of attention always has a center. And that center is not particularly some point that's there in any one of the sides. It's a center where there's equanimity from all four sides. So the center of a square is there by courtesy of the four sides and not there as a point on any one of the sides. So at the center of a square of attention is always the place where the pivot, the axis of interiorization runs through. It's the symbolic aperture, to use a camera term here. So that if you repeated this process over and over again many times, and you began to stack frames of reference, especially using a linked technique so that the frames of reference are stacked in such a way that they're ordered, no matter which frame you take, it will always have a center that's aligned to any other frame of reference's center. So all the centers align. What does he say in the Second Coming? One of the worst things is the feeling that the center will not hold. Things fall apart. They fall apart if you think that the center point was some special content of one of the lines of the frame of reference. And as long as you keep to defining words for meaning, you're trapped in that. You're frozen in that. You're condemned to failure. A definition, by definition, is the boundary around the meaning. When you bound the meaning, that's what the definition is. And if you think the meaning of a word is in its definition, you're condemned to search the frame of reference, the frame of the frame of reference, for the special place where that center is. It's never there. It's never there. It is structurally impossible for it to be there. And in just this way, half-baked wisdom is full-grown idiocy. And that reductive process leads directly into taste for isms, because isms promise that eventually it'll be all right, even though you're killing your relatives because they're not quite agreeing with you. In the end, it'll all be fine. The state will wither away and we'll have paradise. Yeats saw that the frame of reference always, in every case when it was aligned, had a quality that was traditionally characterized by four faculties: sensation, intuition, feeling, thinking. We recognize these four faculties, these four qualities. They're used in Jung's typology and philosophy of symbolic types. They're used in Schiller's typology. They're used in antiquity. In antiquity, in Plato's time, they were given, the four faculties were given the designation of the four elements, fire, earth, air, and water. Same frame of reference, same four sides, same square of attention. In Plato's time, it was called the four elements. In Schiller and Jung and Yeats' time, the four faculties. But Yeats saw it even deeper. He saw that the four faculties have another kind of quality. One of the pair of the qualities in there is symbolized by this beautiful study of Yeats by Richard Ellman, Yeats, The Man and the Masks. So for Yeats, one of the pairs in the four faculties was man and mask. That if you think of it as earth, air, fire, and water, the most that you can do with it is to learn like an old Platonic way of talking about stylizing the frame of reference. If you think about it as the four functions, you get into a psychological tone. But with Yeats, what he wanted to do, he wanted to go deeper. He wanted to get to what traditionally would be called an occult or a hidden level. He wanted to get underneath it all. Not only under the skin, under the epidermis, but he wanted to get down to the bone and get under the bone. He wanted to get into that marrow of the structure. And so he used an old wisdom typology that's much older than feeling, thinking, intuition, sensation, even much older than earth, air, fire, and water. He got down to basic fundamental level when men and women danced for wisdom in Paleolithic times, where man and mask is one of the polarities. And we'll get to these pairs of polarities later on, next week, meaning. But at that level that Yeats could get down to, he found that the figure that was speaking was in common with he and his wife, and that this figure was a seeker after that deepest level himself. He has, in one of his poems, one of his famous poems, a quality one of his last poems, it's called Under Bull Ben. Bull Ben is a huge mountain. And he has these few lines, and we'll end with them, and we'll come back next week. Get start up right here. Many times, man lives and dies between his two eternities, that of race and that of soul. In ancient Ireland knew it all, whether man die in his bed or a rifle knocks him dead, a brief parting from those dear is the worst man has to fear. Though grave diggers' toil is long, sharp their spades, their muscles strong, they but thrust their buried men back into the human mind again. So that it occurred to Yeats that what is peculiar about this all the time is that there's a cycle, but that the cycle, instead of being circular, the cycle slightly rises or slightly falls, and so that the cycle is always spiraling, either up or down, that there's a double spiraling going on. And he called these spirals, he used the ancient medieval term gyre, G-Y-R-E, gyre. And that this gyre This whole spiraling produces a vortex that no matter how wide or how small, how powerful, how esoteric the spiraling is, its center axis, its symbolic pole, always must be motionless. And reoccurs, if you take a cross-section anywhere in the universe, it will always be at the center of whatever frame of reference you take, regardless of how you label it. And that vice versa, like an eternal doctor who knows how to heal, that if you transform the center of any frame of reference, it then can be put back into the stack, no matter how broad it is, and it will recalibrate all of the center points, and the axis will become open. If you find the center focus in any frame of reference, which will be its point of equanimity, its point of rest, its point of meditative calm, its point of certainty of prayer, however you want to say to it, the still, quiet soul point in any frame of reference will be aligned to that point in any frame of reference, no matter where it occurs in whatever time or space or dimensions there are. It's a universal law. And that once one has taken that little molecular part of a problem and transformed it, that then becomes the key to the cure to it all, no matter what disease it is, no matter what its extent, including illusion on level of universal Maya. Because the universal principle, it's like the chemistry of the real. That transformed equanimous seed will transform the whole soul core of every frame of reference, no matter what it is. And they'll all be open. And what happens when they're open? Life dances free every single time. It was once called the good news. More next week.